I am Maggie Dominic, and this is the oral history of Glenn Kubota. It is March 11th, 2019, and we are at the Actors Fund in New York City. So, Glenn, are you part of any other outside things? Do you do any other work other than theater and TV, and what's your role now?
At the present, I'm kind of semi-retired. I'm on Social Security, and I have a pension, another pension kicking in soon. So I'm actually okay financially, so I don't have to work a second job. But I still act, and I go on auditions, and so yeah, I would say that I'm still basically semi-retired and unemployed when I'm not acting, and employed when I am acting.
What was the most recent thing you auditioned for?
It was a play, what was it titled? I can't remember. It was for the Mai Yee Theater Company. Mm-hmm. Nice play. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get it, obviously, but it was a good role. And yeah, that was a lot. That was about a month ago. Mm.
Is there anything on the plate right now that you're looking
at? No, not right now. I think my manager is kind of mad at me because I haven't put together this reel that I was supposed to put together for maybe 6 months ago, but I'm having my son do it, and he's very busy. So, and then I had to track down all these clips from TV and streaming services and films that I did. I finally was able to get a hold of those, but my son, then it got busy again. So mm-hmm. he's kind of like in the last, he's got about maybe two more edits to do with it, and then he'll be ready to post. And then I think she'll be okay. I think she won't be upset with me anymore.
Okay.
But, yeah.
And is this is for a show that you're trying
to? No, it's going to be for my Actors Access. You know, you post your photos, and mm-hmm. you post any clips you have, and any director or casting director could go to Actors Access and look me up and see what I've done in terms of my resume, and then they'll see the clip of TV film work. Yeah, that's pretty much what it's for. I may put it on a website if I eventually get one, and I may even put it on this.
Wonderful.
It's only about two minutes and 40 seconds at this point, so.
Nice.
But yeah. I tell you, it takes a lot of time to put one of those things together because you have to track down all this stuff, you know, and there's all different companies and they all have their own, like we're finding out now, they all have their own policies, but it's surprising what you can find on the internet. And my son does a lot of videography, and he has a way of finding these pirate websites that have films and TV episodes that you can get. So he was able to find two of my films that I couldn't find anywhere on these pirate websites. And so, anyway.
And he copied and pasted and did all the edits?
I only wanted the clips that I was in.
Of course.
You know, so he was able to get two clips from those two pirated films. But those films aren't anywhere. I couldn't find them on Amazon. I couldn't find them on YouTube. But he found them. So
what were the clips? Or the
One was for... what was it? What were they for? I can't remember what they were for. One was for... I'll think about that.
No problem.
Yeah. Oh, one was called Rising Sun.
Mm.
It was a film done in, I think, 2006 or something. 2006, 2007. I played this drug dealer named White Powder Leong. And so I had never seen that film before. And then he found it and said, oh, okay. So that was one of them. And the other one, I can't think what the other one was. But yeah, it was two films that were nowhere to be found. But he found him, so.
How was the role of that?
Oh, it was, you know, he's a drug dealer, so. And actually in that film, the first time I fired a gun on set, because I shoot some guy in the back. And so they had to have There's a special master on set. He's licensed. He only deals with guns. And they take you aside, and they make sure they go over everything with you, you know, and how what you're doing with this gun, you know, how you clip, how you you load it, how you fire it, how you hold it. So that was kind of interesting because I've never fired a gun on set before. And, you know, it was a real gun. But, you know, it had a blanket, obviously, but yeah, it was a pretty heavy gun too. But and then, you know, during my scene, I walk behind a guy and I shoot him in the back. And
how did that feel?
Oh, it was a scene, you know. I'm acting, so it's yeah. I'm sure if I was really a drug dealer, I don't know, I'd probably have to have nerves to still do that. But no, it was just it was. Interesting experience, just the fact that I had to fire this gun on set. So, yeah. They're very particular on how they do that stuff on set, you know. So, obviously, because people have died. Yeah. But anyway.
What other kind of interesting experiences on set have you had?
I was doing this episode of Monsters. It was a syndicated TV show, and I was playing a Vietnamese lieutenant, and the two other characters were American soldiers, and we were down in this tunnels underneath the surface of the ground. Tunnels were where the Viet Cong had all their headquarters. They had basically their whole living community was underground downstairs in these tunnels, so we were down in these tunnels looking for them. And so there's this one scene where this episode was called The Hole. We were in underground in The Hole. And so the series is Monsters, all about different kinds of monsters, whatever. So supposedly in this episode there were these Viet Cong soldiers who had been killed and they had died in the tunnels. They were buried in the walls in order for them to get rid of the bodies, but they would put them in the walls as a way of just, you know, getting rid of the bodies, but also not having to leave bodies on the surface for Americans to find. So these, in this episode, these bodies would come to life sometimes, depending upon who was around. And they'd come out of the walls, and they'd come in. And in fact, some of the other people that we had found in the tunnels had been killed by these monsters. So in the scene that I'm going to tell you about, I'm in the tunnel by myself, and I hear these things coming. I can hear them, like, breathing, and I'm looking around. So in the scene, I'm supposed to shoot them with this gun. But it was a low-budget series, so the action of shooting is like a pantomime. I have the gun in my hand, I'm aiming, and then my hand is reacting like I'm shooting a gun, but they're all going to fill in later. The sound of the gun, they're going to fill in later. The flash from the gun and the noise of it firing. Mm-hmm. So you're only supposed to pantomime, you know, what you're doing. So the scene is set, and I got the gun, and I hear these things coming at me, and I'm looking around, and I see one, so I point the gun, and I'm supposed to pretend I'm shooting, and my hand reacting, but as I was doing it, I was going, like when you're a kid, you're playing Cowboys and Indians, you know, you pretend you're shooting. Mm-hmm. And the director goes, cut, cut, cut. And he's laughing. Everybody in the center is just bowling over laughing. I'm going, what's the matter? He goes, you can't say anything. You're supposed to not say anything. And I go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sure everybody on set was laughing. They couldn't hold that in.
When when I saw it later, when it aired, it was pretty, it looked pretty good. But I thought about what I was doing, and I said, "Oh my God, that was so funny."
Oh my gosh! When they filled all that in,
yeah. Oh. Another time was I was doing a play. In fact, I was doing this play in Maryland. I did it earlier in 2018, January through. In fact, that's the reason why I couldn't do the Cal Project last year.
Oh, right. Because
I booked this play.
Oh, wow.
So, anyway, so I was playing this character that was, he was dying of end-stage liver disease, and he was in bed. He's on stage the whole time in bed, and he's kind of like in a comatose state, so I'm supposed to lay completely still.
Mm.
And not move. And I have scenes every so and then, but they're flashbacks. So I get out of the bed and I do my scene and I come back into bed and I lay still again. So one time, and I've always had this life thought about like religion. My belief is that we live in a universe of cycles. Everything goes around in cycles. Our life is related to a cycle. Mother Nature is related to a cycle. And our own body processes are related to cycles. So if anybody said, "What do you believe in? You know, do you have a religion?" I said, "Yeah, I believe in cycles." So I was laying in bed, and this one particular evening, and the show was going on, And I had been working out at the gym that afternoon before the show, so I was kind of tired. But I was laying there and I felt a little twitch in my left foot, right around the big toe. But I'm laying still. I can't move. So I can't do anything about it. So I felt a twitch, and then I felt it started to tighten, and then I realized I was getting a cramp. In my left foot, while I'm laying in bed, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God!" I got my eyes closed. I'm still, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God! I'm gonna get a cramp on my left foot, my left toe," and it started to tighten, and it got tighter and tighter. And I don't know if you're familiar with cramps, right? Yeah. So it started to really knot up. And my I could feel my left heel kind of bending inward because the muscle was just starting to contract. And I was worried that it was going to move up my leg. It was going to move up to the next muscle and make that one cramp and whatever. So I can't move, so I'm trying to relax, just let it go. But the more I relaxed, the tighter it got. And it started to really hurt. So I'm just laying there, and it's tightening, it's hurting, it's tightening, it's hurting. And then it went away. And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, it went away. Why did it go away? I didn't do anything to it. I didn't try to stretch or anything like that." And I'm thinking, "Oh my gosh, that's the thing about cycles. Nature goes in cycles." And sure, it came back. The cramp came back again later on after it went away. It came back and then it went away again. I said, "Oh wow." So that was like a lesson that there's cycles. And
what happened?
Excuse me. I'm going to tell you this, but it's kind of R-rated.
Be careful.
So about a week later, into the same run, this was a Sunday matinee.
Mm-hmm.
I had that morning. I always walked down to the bay. This was in Baltimore. I walked down to the Inner Bay to get the Sunday New York Times at a Starbucks. So when I was there at Starbucks, I got myself one of these bacon, egg, cheese muffins that they have for breakfast, and I ate that there. And I walked back to the apartment. And you know, I usually eat those, and I mean not a lot, but I eat them once in a while. So, anyways, so as the opening act is about to begin, I'm laying in bed. I'm still backstage. They haven't rolled me out yet. I get a little gurgle in my stomach. Oh, what's that? Okay. So, lying there, and then the scene opens, the partition opens, and they roll me out onto the stage, the nurse, and I'm there for the beginning of the first act. And I'm laying there, and I'm getting another gurgle in my stomach. I'm like, oh, what is that? Then I felt something like going down my stomach, down my lower intestines, and I'm like, oh my God, I have the runs. I have the runs, and I'm lying in bed here on stage, and I can't do anything about it. I can't move anything. And I'm lying there, and it's getting more pressure. There's more pressure coming, and it's getting like to the point where I'm going, oh my God, what am I gonna do? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do?
What did you do?
Again, Mother Nature. The only thing I could move, the only thing, only muscle I could move in my body was my sphincter.
Oh, my.
But that was like,
oh, you motherfucker, you shall not pass. No way, no way.
So I was just squeezing
and it went away?
It went away.
Like the cycles.
It went away. It came back later.
But, oh, wow.
It came back later, and I
saved
really had
you.
To squeeze again, squeeze
oh,
again.
Oh, boy.
But it went away. And when it went away, it bought me more time.
Yeah.
Because the scene was about an hour. And it was about 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But when it went away, it bought me more time. So finally, when the first act, you know, finished, the lights went down,
I just ran
off the stage.
Of course. What was the name of this production?
Aubergine.
Aubergine.
Yeah. It played at Second Stage about 2 years ago. And then it went down to Baltimore. But there again, the cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Your body goes in cycles, you know. And so that was another thing. So, oh, okay. I'm sorry, I had to share that.
That's crazy.
But those are things that you can tell, like, at a party, you know. Oh, what happened?
Little things that you went... Oh, well, not even little things. Big things that you went
man.
Through.
Later on, that night at the evening performance, I talked to the stage manager and told her what happened. And she was like, whoa. I said, what do I do if that happens again? She says, well, you know what? If that happens again, you signal to one of the actors. The actor will signal to the stage manager and we'll stop the show.
Wow.
You just leave and do what you gotta do and come back.
That's amazing though.
Yeah,
oh.
Do it again. She said that's never happened in all the years that she had been a stage manager, is that somebody
right.
Had, yeah. And I said, you know, the thing was, I mean, I could have just stayed there and done it. She says, but that would have ruined the bed. That would have ruined everything for the She says, No, she says what you do next time is you signal and let us stop the show. I said, okay. So,
good to know.
Yeah. I mean, luckily it didn't happen again, but that was good.
Good. I'm glad you didn't have to experience that again.
Yeah, right. Anyway, you shouldn't ask me that question.
How about your favorite scene or favorite encounter in a performance or backstage?
You know, I'm thinking in terms of favorite. I guess that could mean a lot of different
mm-hmm.
things to people. What your favorite is? I'm not sure about that. What my favorite? I don't know if I have a favorite. I have memorable things, but I don't know. I have a favorite. At least I can't think of one right now.
What about a memorable thing? Something positive, something.
I think.
Meeting someone on set.
You know, because I have this issue with my speech.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had to do an Asian accent, I found that it didn't affect my speech fluency. It was almost like somebody else talking, because I don't normally speak with an accent. So I had to add it. If I had it to add an accent, it was to portray this other character, which wouldn't be me because I don't have an accent. So that little adjustment, it just made the world of difference. I mean, I don't recall any of the characters that I played that had an accent that I had any issues with the disfluency. And also, like, I also played this one character named Sam. He was an old, wise samurai, so I gave him kind of a low, gruff voice. Like, he talked like this. And that, too, it was somebody else talking, it wasn't me. So it wasn't me putting myself out there for people to see and people to hear. Mm-hmm. It was somebody else. And I never had a problem. And that was kind of like a revelation to me. And I mean, given how the industry is, particularly the film and TV industry, is good at stereotyping Asians, I've had many roles where I had to have an accent. And those roles were like good roles, and they weren't roles that I had to struggle with.
Did you look for roles with a particular?
No, I just went on the auditions that I was told to go on. Although, you know, one thing about the TV and film auditions that I went on early in my career, I didn't want to. I needed to limit my exposure in those two mediums, particularly because if I had an issue with any lines or any words, you don't have much time to work on it. You go on set, you shoot it however many times you need, and you don't get to rehearse it. Whereas on stage, you know, you have the script before you even start rehearsals, you know, but what lines are going to give you problems, what words are going to give you problems, so you can work on it. You kind of like work your way into it. And if you get on stage and you still have the problem, then you find something else to deal with it. But in TV and film, you didn't have that time to work with it. So when early in my career, I tried to limit the exposure that I would have in front of a TV camera. Or any kind of camera, so that, like if there was a major character, and he had all these lines, I wouldn't want that role, because it would just scare the hell out of me, for one thing, and then I would have to try to find a way to deal with those particular speech issues, and so. And you know what, I probably did not try as hard if it was a large role, because I really didn't want to get it, you know. It would have been too much exposure for me. But yeah, as far as any particular roles, no, I just went on any audition that she sent me on, so.
And do you want to talk about of that speech disfluency, or
yeah,
how you got over it? Or?
So, I mean, I went into the acting profession essentially as an exercise in therapy. I had no interest in the theater. I had no interest in becoming an actor before I went into those two endeavors. My whole thing was, I grew up with a speech disfluency, and I was able to live with it, and I found ways to deal with it, and in some ways I was able to hide it. A lot of people knew who I grew up with, even some members of my extended family never knew I had this speech issue, because I would always, if there were certain things that I could. Like, for instance, if it was if I had a bad day, I just wouldn't talk. I wouldn't say anything. So there were these little things that I used to mask it. And then, so high school was kind of hard for me because it was a whole new environment. So I kept pretty quiet. I was very shy and quiet in high school. College was a little bit easier because when you major in something, you're around the same people all the time, so you become more familiar, more comfortable. So I didn't have as much problem with my speech, although I still had issues with it. And so I became less shy, but still quiet. But when I got into the, when I graduated, I got a very good job with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And I was able to do my work pretty efficiently. I did a good job. I was a program rep with the 701, the 701 program. They give grants to cities and counties. And I was able I was able to manage because I had these little techniques that I used to hide. And I was going along pretty good until they reorganized my my department, and they consolidated it and sent me to San Francisco. Mm. And the department head there, he was a very progressive department head, and he gave the representatives, the reps, a lot of leeway in how we ran our program, and he gave us more voice in how we distributed this grant money. So, which was good because a lot of my colleagues were really excited about that, and I was excited about it too. Except when we got into the room to divide up the money, the Washington sent a pool of money to us to divide up amongst our clients, cities and counties, and so each of the reps had their own projects. So. And obviously, there wasn't enough money to go around for all the projects, so you had to basically jockey, and it was like horse trading. And so, when they started like questioning my projects and asking for details to justify, you know, why this budget was what it was, I started to lock up. I couldn't speak out and defend my projects. And I realized, I said, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to do this job to the degree that I want to be able to do it if I don't find somewhere to deal with my speech. And I just happened to be on the board of directors of this Asian theater company in San Francisco. And they encouraged the board members to take the classes that they have. So I took this acting class, and I didn't feel threatened or concerned because a lot of people that were in the class were people that I knew. So it didn't seem to be at least an issue for me at that time. And I don't know, for some reason, there was this final presentation of this class, and I wrote a monologue about these farmers in Central California, Japanese-American farmers who were coming back from the war after the internment camps, and they were meeting with a white Caucasian farmer who was very sympathetic to their plight, and he was trying to embrace them and welcome them back. So I wrote this monologue, and I performed it myself, and it kind of blew them away. They said, wow, that's really great. And you did it really well. So they encouraged me to apply for this summer congress at the American Conservatory Theater. And I said, oh, wow. All right, I'm going to try that. Because I had read about and seen articles on these actors and singers who stuttered in real life, but when they performed, they didn't. So the thought about that kind of intrigued me, and I thought, oh, let me consider this. That might be a way for me to overcome this. So I auditioned, and they worked with me. They picked a monologue from me. They worked with me. Some of them knew I had problems, but they didn't treat me any different than the other actors. So I auditioned and I got in, and it was like, whoa. In fact, this is what this is about. It was a send-off. It was a send-off party for me from the people who I worked with at HUD as I went into the summer Congress. And so they gave me, turned me a party. And so I got in there, and it was just an incredible experience because I'd never known any actors or been with any actors or have any idea what actors do. And then I saw it at the ground level, at the very initial stages of learning how to be an actor and what the theater was about. So I found it very interesting, but I still had trouble with my speech. But the voice and the speech exercises that they make you go through were just so helpful. They gave me a structure to work with, and a structure that I could use on my own at home, you know. And so I still use those exercises today. And that was like 40 years ago. And so so after the summer Congress finished, they invited me back for the advanced program. And so then I knew I had, because I took a leave of absence from my job. So because they invited me back for the full year, I had to basically decide whether I wanted to do that or quit my job at HUD. So I said, I'm going to quit my job because I find that these exercises, speech and voice, are helping me. And also there's this thing in speech therapy called desensitizing. And it's a situation where you put yourself in situations where you have to, say, order a cup of coffee in a store in front of people that you don't know. And it's a way for you to fight through the speech block. It's a way for you to feel how you feel when you're under that kind of stress. And the more often you do it, the easier it becomes. So if you did it today, you do it tomorrow, it's going to be just a little bit easier to do it tomorrow. So that's what the stage work did for me, getting in front of people, doing scenes, having to do my lines. It was bumpy, and it was rough, and it was very humiliating sometimes. But I knew that there would be an endpoint where it was going to help me. So I found that advanced program to be so beneficial for me because it set me on a path. It gave me a structure to work on my own and in front of people, and it gave me basically hope. So when that advanced program finished, I had I was at a crossroads. What do I do with this knowledge now? What do I do with these tools that I learned? And they were good tools. They're really advanced voice technique, speech technique, and they were the perfect thing that I needed to address my speech block. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to go where the theater is, and the theater is in New York. So I told my parents. They were like, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? Giving up that job to do that? But they didn't know that I was dealing with the speech issue. They just thought I was one of these quixotic adventurers to whatever, learn more about myself. And that was fine. I don't care. I mean, it was my journey, and I was going to take it. So I moved to New York, and I flew into New York on the red eye, and JFK, and I had rented a room at the Vanderbilt YMCA, and at the YMCA you could only rent rooms at a day at a time, but at that time it was like $12.
What year was this?
it would have been 79. Hmm. So it was $12 per day, not per day. I guess.
Per night.
Yeah, per night. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had to renew it every morning when mm-hmm. you got up. So I said, what I'll do is I'll get a room there, and then I'll renew it every day, every morning, and then I would go down to the East Village. Were people who from New York living in California told me that might be the most affordable place to live in terms of, you know, moving into the city and struggling artists. And so that's where I went. I took a bus down there every day to the East Village, and I walked around. I finally found an apartment. I found this apartment it was $115 a month. And it was in pretty bad. I wouldn't say it was a rat trap, but it was right maybe a notch above a rat trap. But it was a home. It was a place that I moved into, and that's where I started. And that was on East Fifth Street, and I stayed there for a year. And then, you know, it was what they call a cold water flat. It's where they had a tub in the kitchen, because when those buildings were built, they were built as tenements for working class people who worked for the wealthy on the Upper East Side of New York. So they would, I guess, take trolley cars, whatever, home to these tenements, but the tenements didn't have hot water, they only had cold water. So they would heat the water on the stove and put it in the tub. And the toilet was actually a water closet. It was a little room, a toilet, and a pool chain for the toilet, for the flush. And so I lived there for a year, and I did all my speech exercises, all my voice exercises. I did them religiously every day. Sometimes I spent maybe a couple hours doing them. And then I started auditioning. And how much time do we have?
It's been 30 minutes.
Oh, okay. So yeah, that was pretty much it. That's how I got to New York. And so that was in 1979. That's 2019 now. So we're talking 40 years. I guess I consider myself a New Yorker, although I still love California. I'll probably never get California out of my system, but you know, when I go home, it's still the same state that I knew. It doesn't have any seasons, basically. It's not like New York. But yeah, I've been in since 79, and then you know, the thing about these kind of odysseys, when you start out, you don't always imagine everything. So I didn't imagine I would get married, but I did get married. And I had a son, and so that became a whole different type of awareness, aside from just living in New York, aside from trying to be an actor, aside from having a survival job to try to help pay my bills. I also had to become a father, and so that was a very eye-opening and growing experience for me to put so much time and effort into to being a father. In fact, what I did was I went on hiatus from Actors Equity for 14 years, from 1994 to 2008, because I had become a single parent. We divorced, and so I had custody of my son. So in order to devote all my time and effort to him, I committed myself to being home for him every evening, for his homework, for all his needs, and things like that. So obviously I couldn't do the theater anymore. So that's why I had to honorable withdrawal from Actors Equity for those 14 years. Although I could still do things like TV and film and commercials and print work, but if only they only if they shot in the city and they shot in the daytime. So I was still able to keep that part of my creative process going, but I didn't do any theater. In fact, luckily I was able to do that because it helped with my Screen Actors Guild pension, because I kept working all those years, and I didn't really have a lot of downtime as far as income from the Screen Actors Guild pension.
Outside of theater or outside of film and movies, did you ever have to take up another job?
I used to work at this place called the Art Directors Club. It was a trade association for art directors in advertising, graphic design, new media. And it was the oldest organization of its kind in the United States. It was founded in 1922 here in New York. And they had this annual competition. Any art director could submit work for any work they did the previous 12 months in advertising, graphic design, or new media. And they would have this judging. They would judge the work. It was curated and judged. And then you would win awards. And you'd get gold medal, silver medal, bronze medal. And then they would have an exhibition, and then they have a traveling show, and then they would have an annual, a book with all these awards in it, and the credits and stuff like that. So it was a pretty prestigious organization for many, many, many years. And when I started working for it in Yeah, I started working there as just like a temporary person, helping out with the awards, because they would get like 20,000 entries every year from all around the world for this judging, because it was pretty prestigious. If you got picked for the exhibition, that was pretty prestigious, but if you won an award, that was even more, you know, particularly the gold medal. You can put that on your resume and people would notice that. So it was a lot of intense work leading up to this competition. So people would submit all this work and we would have to process it and organize it and put it in a position where it can be judged by other professionals in the field. They would come in over a weekend, maybe 30, 40 of these people come and look at advertising, 30, 40 come and look at graphic design, new media. And so it was a pretty involved process. So I was working there temporary. I knew two of the other people who worked there because they were actors. And in fact, they told me about the job. And so I worked there for like almost, I worked there for 23 years. That was my survival job. And it was a good job because the people there who ran it, the executive director, they were all supportive of actors. So if you got a job, you could leave. They would fill in for you. You wouldn't lose your job. You'd come back and your job would still be there. So it was a pretty good deal. It was almost a perfect survival job to have. Because the work itself was so interesting, because it's all this work that comes from around the world, that's advertising, graphic design, you know, and so you don't get bored, you know, it's not like you're, you know, making something every day, it's the same thing every day. It was all different. So over that 23 years, I worked in the exhibition department, I worked as a house manager. And the last job I had before I was fired was I was managing the traveling exhibitions. The traveling exhibitions were all over the world. They had 5 exhibitions. So I would book all the shows in other countries for these 5 shows. But anyway, so what happened was that the executive director, who had been there for like 10 years, she was very supportive of actors. She was replaced by another woman who was the wife of this very famous graphic designer. And she was there for about maybe 12 years, and she was very supportive of actors. But when she left, they brought somebody else in that was not as supportive of actors, but she also had this reputation for trying to turn around companies, entities. And so the entries to our competition had been declining every year, a little bit, maybe 1,000 less, whatever. So they were kind of worried. So they brought this woman in to try to like maybe correct that. And one of the first things she did was to fire me, because I had been for 23 years. And she wanted, I believe, I mean, I never found out the true reason. I believe she wanted to set the tone of that office. You know, if he was here for 23 years and he's expendable, everybody else is expendable. So she fired me. She I didn't even get a watch or even a going away lunch. She just fired me, and I had to leave right then. So that was kind of an interesting experience. Mm-hmm. But I loved that job for all the time I was there, and it served me well because I was able to help pay my bills, and I could do my work, my acting when I wanted to. So it was fine. I didn't care. I mean, I'd been there enough.
All right. So we're coming to the end. Is there anything that you'd like to add, or we'll pick up maybe next time?
Yeah. You know, I want to talk about this project, the PAL project. So being that it's geared toward people who are kind of like, you know, in their twilight or toward the ends of their career, although by no means it means you're going to stop acting, whatever, but, you know, you're looking at the legacy, what mm-hmm. you've done over this period of years prior to today. And so I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking, you know what? This project is almost like the period at the end of a story. So once that story is finished, basically you can almost like move on to something else.
I like that.
You can move on to doing something else, like opening up a restaurant, move to another state, do something else. But it's, I mean, I'm not saying that I'm going to do that or that I want to do that, but it is. I'm putting my entire life from 1979 to 2019 into this PAL project. There are going to be some highlights about what was good about what I was doing, maybe some areas where I had struggled. But it's all going to be in a package, and it's going to be right there on a website that you can look at and say, okay, that's Glenn Kubota, and that's his legacy. That's it. Off to the sunset. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't expect to think about that or even feel that way about it when I first started doing it. But the more I'm looking at stuff, the more I'm writing things down, the narratives, I'm bringing all this stuff back, all these memories and thoughts about, oh, what I've done. Mm. And I'm thinking, man, I've accomplished what I wanted to do. I don't have the speech disfluency anymore. So why not? Why not make this PAL project the period at the end of my story?
All right. Thank you so much, Glenn.
You're welcome.